Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a college of arts and sciences and music conservatory, offering a global education featuring research, internships, and study abroad. Lawrence.edu. Support for WPR comes from the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, with the 50th annual Birds in Art exhibition. New avian-themed works from around the world through January 4th. LYWAM.org.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, you know what? It's time to take a look at your vehicle, as winter is definitely here. If you haven't done everything you needed to do, or if you found out something relating to the snow and ice that you need to have fixed, Jim Ward's back with us to help you out. Jim is retired service manager of Smart Motors, where he worked for 36 years. A lot of snow and ice ahead, so it's still not too late to winterize your car, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. Love to hear from you. What issues are you having with your vehicle? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234. Could call 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
You know, I had my car in a couple days ago just for rotating the tires, and then they told me at Smart that I need to get my brakes taken care of. So tomorrow morning I'm having the brakes fixed. Fortunately, the tires, mine, are in good conditions, but having good tires and brakes on your vehicles, I think, kind of crucial for safe winter driving. How do you know if your tires can handle snow and ice?
Well, the tread depth is the primary metric that we use, and tread depth that you need in the winter is what we know that we need more tread in the wintertime and snow, but you know, I'm looking out my window right now and it's raining, and you know, in any time of year, rain is just as much of a challenge as ice and snow. You can hydroplane on rain, and again, the key to keeping your traction both in acceleration and in stopping is good tread depth. So tread depth is really critical, but you know, another factor, depending on where you live and where you have to drive, the kind of tire you have, there are winter tires and summer tires and all season tires, and they will handle quite a bit differently in cold conditions and in snow acceleration, snow braking as well. So if you, you know, if you live somewhere out and about where you know you're going to have to drive on snow covered roads a lot, snow tires are something you definitely want to consider in that situation.
Absolutely. I just think about accidents. If you know, accidents, you got slippery conditions, that's difficult. Tire tread, it does affect a vehicle's stopping distance?
It does. It does. You know, a winter tire, if you're going 40 miles an hour on snow, a winter tire may stop your car in about 150 feet. An all-season tire in about 175, and a summer tire may take 350 feet. That's a lot of difference in how quickly you may come to a stop. You know, and in acceleration, too, 0 to 40, it's about 14 and a half seconds with an all-season tire, about 41.7 with a summer tire, and 11.7 with a winter tire. Not that we want to be speed demons. You know, the key is accelerate easy, brake easy. But, you know, the kind of conditions we have causes the situations and emergencies that come up very, very quickly. And you know, you don't have a lot of time to react. Driver reaction is also a huge part of all of this, but you want everything in your favor. So good tread depth and the right tire for where you have to drive are really key in that.
It's and also maintaining a little distance with the car that's in front of you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Driver reaction can only go so far if you've only got a few feet to deal with.
Somebody's already wondering, if you buy new tires, do you have to replace all four at the same time?
Well, all four tires should be, you know, we've been talking about winter tires, summer tires, all-season tires. All the tires should be the same kind of tire at any given time of year, and you don't necessarily have to replace all four tires at the same time. Generally, tire shops are going to recommend that you put your new tires on the front. and if you have a rear-wheel drive vehicle, some of them are. That may not seem logical, but that still gives you the best handling. It isn't essential that you replace them at the same time, but another key factor here is that more and more people drive vehicles that are all-wheel drive systems, and all-wheel drive systems are very particular about the difference between the thickest and the thinnest tread depth on the tires, and generally they don't want that to be greater than 3/32 of an inch. So, you know, if you have a set of tires that's at 6/32 and a set that's at 2, you're going to replace the ones at 2. The ones at 6 would probably be okay, but if the new ones are 10, they're too far apart for an all-wheel drive system. It can cause damage to the drivetrain. So there's a lot to take into account when you're thinking about replacing just a couple of tires.
Yeah, and one final thing before we get to Barbara in Glenwood, and that relates to pressure. The pressure dash light seems to come on a whole lot more during the cold months, of course.
Yep, there is more. There's more air loss. I mean, it's natural that there's going to be some air loss from tires over time, but it is more pronounced in cold. It's especially pronounced when we have a sudden cold drop. Tonight's going to be a prime example of that. Here we're in the 40s, and by tomorrow morning it's going to be single digits, and that's the classic scenario where tire light wasn't on today, but it may very well be on tomorrow morning. That doesn't necessarily mean the tire's flat or too low to drive, but if the tire pressure is supposed to be 35 pounds, that tire light will come on when it's 7 pounds low. And again, for many people, that scenario is going to occur overnight tonight.
Well, I guess I'm going to be lucky because I'm taking my car in tomorrow morning to get the brakes fixed. They'll be looking at the tires.
They'll set them up. Yes, they will.
Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa, we'll turn to you now. I think you have something relating to batteries.
I do, and I'm so glad you're on today. You're just so appropriate. 2 days ago when I went out to my garage to toddle around town and do 100 Christmas errands, pushed the button on my Chrysler Town & Country, and it went rrr, rrr, and nothing happened. So after I got a mechanic out, he said, your battery's dead. You need a new battery. Well, it's almost exactly 2 years old. Was there any way I could have known beforehand that it was nearing the end of its life?
Did you, when you tried to start it, did it actually turn over and just go, rrr, 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 or did it go tick, tick, tick?
No, it made that noise but did not start.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and neither one of those are very encouraging sounds to hear on a busy day when you've got Christmas errands to run. Click, 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 or rrr, rrr, rrr. If it doesn't start and run. Well, Barbie, you asked if you could have known. Modern battery testers do have a pretty uncanny ability to predict how long a battery has for life yet. It isn't 100% accurate, but they will often tell you. And you know, a lot of people become skeptical. It's like, well, my car's starting fine. But one of the biggest challenges is that what your car needs to start in the cold and what it needs to start in warmer weather, in the way of power from the battery and in the way of the added drag it has to overcome from the engine, is a great difference. And so theoretically, you know, a vehicle is taken to a shop about every 6 months, or you do your own maintenance. And if you do your own maintenance every 6 months, or if a shop does it, one of the things that you should be doing, or they're likely doing, is using one of those battery testers and would potentially be able to tell you that a battery may fail. They don't always get it right. Sometimes batteries fail when it said it was good. And one of my bosses once wanted to be stubborn, and his battery said it failed, and it was starting well. And so he said, you know, I've got a jump pack I keep in the vehicle. I'm going to see how long it goes. And he went 3 years. But that definitely was an outlier. You know, most of the time, if they tell you that battery is on its last legs, you probably have a few months or till the next cold morning.
Oh, Barbara, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Maybe you got a battery question or a tire question or something else bothering you with your car. Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Catherine emailed to say she has a 2012 Prius V with 112,000 miles on it. Catherine keeps the car in the garage, but on cold mornings around 20 degrees or colder, the little shifter lever shifts out of reverse or forward and into neutral for the first 30 seconds to several minutes. She has to hold the lever in place in order to back out of the driveway. Catherine hasn't taken the car into the shop yet because it's sporadic and temperature dependent. She's wondering if you've ever seen this happen before and what it might be.
I have heard of that, and there most shift linkages have a device called a detent, which is a little bearing that's the shape of a capsule, like a capsule, a little pill, and it's in a little cylinder and it's spring loaded, and it's supposed to pop out and hold something like that shifter position in place. And when it's cold, it can get sticky and not, it doesn't pop back out, and there's nothing there that can hold it in place, and the shifter is free to shift back into neutral. They're really, I would check with the Toyota dealer and check to see if there's any bulletins on updates. They may have redesigned that because some of these assemblies are known to have more problems than others. But there really isn't, I don't know, of maintenance you can do to it. You can't really get at that detent bearing and, like, lubricate it or anything. So, I don't know of a repair. You'd have to probably replace the shifter assembly to correct that. But if you're going to do that, then you do want to find out if there's an updated, newer style you should be replacing it with.
Yeah. And that could be, that cost you a couple of dollars.
It would. I can't tell you. I don't know that off the top of my head, but it's going to be in the range of hundreds, not in the range of $10, $20. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Jake in Brussels, Wisconsin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Merry Christmas, guys.
To you as well.
Merry Christmas.
My question is this. I got an 05 RAV4. It's got almost 300,000 miles on it, but the all-wheel drive does not kick in. It's just running on front-wheel drive. Any ideas what that could be?
Do you have a warning light on when you try to use it?
Yeah. All the time I have the VSC track on.
Yeah. There's some kind of electric problem. There's a sensor or something that's not telling the computer what it wants to see to be able to allow that all-wheel drive system to engage. When the light's on, that means there's going to be some diagnostic code registered that are going to help narrow down whether it's a connection, a sensor, or some other component in the system that isn't communicating with the rest of it, not allowing it to work. So to follow up on that, the next step is going to be to read those codes and see what they're trying to tell us.
Yeah, and so that for that, you need to take it in, I would guess.
Well, yeah, it's not like, and it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to be a Toyota dealer to have that diagnostic equipment. Any shop can buy a scanner and can get a subscription with Toyota to do those kind of diagnostics, but an individual's not going to have that in his garage. It's about $7,500 for the unit, and then several hundred dollars a year for the subscription. So, yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be a Toyota dealer, but someone with that equipment's going to need to do some checking.
All right, so get it in, Jake. Thank you for calling. Gary in Madison, your turn.
Yes, I actually am looking at a vehicle at one of your locations. My question is the difference between the Ford F-150 3.5 and the 2.7. I know that, that one has more towing capacity, but I mean, is there reason to go with one or the other? Are there problems with one of them, or?
I'm not an expert on Ford engines. I know, I believe one of these engines has got the capability of, depending on which model you have, of changing how many cylinders are operating. And those systems have been a little problematic with some carbon buildup. From there, it really depends on what you need to tow. I'm a fan of engines that are about the range of that 2.7 size. You can get some halfway decent gas mileage when you're not towing. And, depending on what you need to tow up to, depending on the gearing and the model of the vehicle, potentially up to 9,000-10,000 pounds could be towed with that. But if you got to tow heavier things, that bigger engine is going to be what you want to go with.
There you go, Gary. Thank you very much for calling. Barbara in Milwaukee emailed to say Barbara is in the market for a new set of tires for her car. It's a 2013 Honda CR-V. She was told that between the green, yellow, and red ratings for the tread, theirs are now at yellow. Barb is planning to get all-season tires. How do you determine the best brand?
Well, one of the best things you can do is go online, there's the different business. Tire Rack is one of them that sells tires online. And look at reviews and look at what people say about them. Tire manufacturers change up the models, names, the tire industry is not an industry that's got a great amount of standardization among tires to be able to easily do those comparisons. So what a given year's set of series of tires that any given manufacturer comes out with could vary quite a bit from what they were in other years. So those reviews of some of the latest purchases, you want to look at reviews from 2 years ago, but reviews from like the last 6 months are really probably one of your best bets.
That makes some sense to me. Thank you very much for that email, Barbara. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, retired services manager at Smart Motors Toyota, with us. Great to have him here, and you can join in with your car question. Give a call, the number 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly, or you could email us as well. Email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your automobile today, your vehicle, with Jim Ward, retired services manager of Smart Motors. It's great to have him back. And again, questions for him, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Jane in an email doesn't drive her car a lot, but was told her tires, there's incidents of tire dry rot. What the heck is that, and does she need new tires?
Well, that is primarily the effect of the sun on tires. The sun will oxidize the rubber and cause that kind of dry rot, and it's something that we deal with in Wisconsin, something they deal with a lot more in Arizona and areas where they have that kind of intense sun exposure. But most manufacturers of tires are going to have a mileage that they say their tires will go to, and they'll also have a year range. So they may say, and most of them, the years are going to be 5-6 years. So, you know, it feels great. I'm retired the last 5 years. I'm not driving as much. Don't put as many miles on my tires, but that doesn't mean that I'm still not going to have to replace them at 5-6 years. It's like so many things, you know, that the sun is really hard on, and the heat can be really hard on a lot of different aspects of automotive maintenance and dependability, and tires and batteries both are things that are affected by heat and direct effect of sunlight. You probably do need to replace those tires.
Yeah. Hans in Kakana will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Hans.
Hello. I recently purchased a new car. I'm not going to tell you the dealer or the brand, but after we agreed upon a price, I told him I do not want to buy an extended warranty. You're supposed to be a reliable car. And he kept trying to push me, being I'm an old fart. And just how are those guys incentivized, and how effective are they really? Because that concerned me that if it's supposed to be that reliable, why are they pushing so hard to the extended warranty? Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a good question, and extended warranties, to me, are something that may be appropriate depending on your circumstances. If you look at the new warranty that you get on a car, you know, it's not going to cover wear items. So if you are hard on tires, or if you're hard on brakes, wipers, those kind of things are considered wear items. They're not going to be covered to be replaced, but they're also not going to typically wear out within the first 3 years or, you know, 36,000 miles. So, you know, if you look at that warranty and look at specifically what it covers, it makes a lot of difference on what you intend to do with that car. If you intend to keep that car for 10 years, that extended warranty may become particularly valuable in years after the three-year warranty is up, between years like 3 and 5 or 6, depending on how long you take an extended warranty out. If you trade your car every 3 or 4 years, then it really doesn't make a lot of sense, because during the period that you own that car, most things that would be covered, because the extended warranties don't cover the wear items either, so that most items that might come up are going to be covered by the factory warranty, and then you trade the car in. So if you are planning to keep the car long term, you might want to consider an extended warranty. I've not been a particular fan of them myself, but you know, at the time, my own kids have taken out warranties for different things, tire warranties, where and used them quite a bit, and said, boy, I'm sure glad I did this. you know, by and large, insurance is insurance, and what it means in all insurance is that most people aren't going to be able to use it. A few do use it, and that's how insurance companies make the money. So how are you going to use that car? How long do you plan to keep it? That's really one of the key questions on whether you want to consider an extended warranty.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thanks, Hans, for calling. Louise in Eau Claire, we'll go to you now. Hi, Louise.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a Honda CRV 2013, and when I unlock it with my key fob, if I don't get out in the garage immediately or within like 5 seconds or 8 seconds, the car relocks itself. And I'm wondering, what am I doing wrong? Is there any way anything I can do to fix this? Because it's really frustrating.
Interesting, Louise. Let me make sure I understand this right. So if you don't back out of the car, out of the garage, within just a few seconds, it relocks itself. But if you do back out of the garage that quickly, it doesn't relock?
No. I'm in the car, in the house, getting ready to go someplace, and
okay.
I know the car is locked, and I unlock it from inside the house.
Gotcha.
And if I don't get out into the garage within 5 seconds to get into the car, or if I'm at the shopping center and I unlock it when I'm still getting to it. If I don't get to it within 6-7 seconds,
sure,
it relocks itself.
Okay. Yep. Typically, there's a security feature. Your car probably has factory security system. It might have an aftermarket security system, but it's a security system that's doing that. And the security system I'm sure that this CRV has this, will have the ability to be adjusted. You may not be able to do it as a consumer. You may have to go to a shop. You may have to go to a Honda dealer where they can hook it up to a laptop or a device, and they can set different parameters for that. So it could be set to relock the doors in 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, or not at all. And so that is what needs to be addressed here, is that sounds like your system is set up to relock. It's high security, set up to relock it almost, you know, immediately if a door is not open and you don't get in it. So that is it's possible that you may have some malfunction in one of those systems going on, because, man, that sounds awful quick. I didn't really think they had them even available to relock within 30 seconds, but I could be wrong on that. That's the first step I would take. You go to a dealer, have them hook it up and see if they can adjust that to a longer parameter or turn it off for you if you don't think you need it.
Yeah, there you go, Louise. And it shouldn't be too expensive to do that.
You know, I've done it as a courtesy for people, but I wouldn't be surprised if a shop had a nominal fee for something like that.
Yeah, nominal. And maybe if you got to go in for an oil change, that might be the time to bring it up.
Right, yeah.
And maybe they'll just do it for free. Louise, thanks. Appreciate it. John in Spooner, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing today, Larry? Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Hey, I got a question for your guest there. And this is always it seems like you can ask a million people and get a million and five answers. But when it comes to tire pressure, so in my instance, I have a Econoline 350 van, but I don't run with any load in it. But the tire pressure says 80 psi cold at maximum load, and the door jam says 65 psi. But so, is there any way? I mean, should it be within 10% of the maximum cold pressure that the tire states, or is it always with the door jam tire pressure, regardless of what the tire rating is? How does that actually work?
The second one is right. It's always what the door jam says. The tire manufacturer makes that tire has no idea what vehicle is going on, what the weight of that vehicle is, and what the dynamics are going to be. So the tire manufacturer is putting something on that tire that says, no matter what you put this on, this is the maximum weight. But the manufacturer of the vehicle recommends a specific size tire, and they know, based on that vehicle, what the weight is. So that door jam placard is definitely what you want to use. That being said, it's not at all unusual. We were just discussing a few minutes ago the seasonal variation in tire pressures, how they'll drop some, you lose some air pressure in the wintertime, particularly on a severe drop in temperature on an overnight like we're supposed to have tonight. You may drop enough to be 7 to 10 PSI. So most manufacturers have a chart that they'll say, you know, if your customer's in here and if you're doing your own tires, you may want to look at some information up. But they'll say, you know, if the next 6 months the weather's going to be, you know, cold, winter cold, then increase those tire pressures from that 65 to something not a whole lot more, maybe 3 pounds more, but they will have a chart that shows a slightly increased pressure for cold temperatures to try to compensate for that air loss. So you don't want to increase it very much, but you can increase it a little bit. But hopefully that answers your question, John.
John, thank you very much for calling. So we turn next to an email from Diane. In the winter, they have problems with the gas tank cover door freezing on their 2015 Subaru Legacy. Is there anything Diane can do to clean it or lubricate it so it doesn't freeze shut?
I'm not exactly sure what is freezing. I believe that this is a fuel door that has a release inside the car.
Yeah.
I don't think this is one that you're able to just open from the outside with your hands. And I don't think it's as likely that the door itself is freezing, for example, like to the body of the car, is that cable is slightly out of adjustment or something's not quite right there. So there are adjustments that can be done on that cable, and there are adjustments that can be done simply on the spring on the fuel door itself that usually will address that and help that. They're a little bit different from model to model, and I can't quite picture exactly what that car has and where those adjustments would be, but it is possible to address that, yes.
Yeah, all right. Dennis emailed to say they've heard that soy-based rubber tires may be available or might be available. People might wonder why those are better than petroleum based tires. Soy-based tire bits might cause less pollution. What do you think?
You know, I haven't read much about soy-based tires yet. I think it's always interesting. New technology, new innovation, new resources and supplies come along. You know, an interesting thing to consider, though, and this is almost humorous, but, you know, when car manufacturers decided to go with less toxic materials for things like the wiring insulation that's on the wiring in a car, what they went with is certainly less polluting than the kind of plastics that had previously been used, but they turned out to be a delicacy for mice and many rodents who would chew up the wires because it smelled like food to them. So I'm just imagining down the road some beaver chewing on your tire. Now, I don't, you know, I can't imagine it, but ultimately, you know, if it turns out that it's a better resource that's a more renewable and less polluting to dispose of, I'm all for it. But I don't have a lot of information about this particular idea yet.
I like your wire story, though. Lynn in Stevens Point called, couldn't stay with us. Lynn has a 2015 Prius V. It's a display screen for the radio and such. Turns itself off and on. Does it need to be reset?
Kind of a known issue with those things going black like that, and it's a circuit problem inside of it. And unfortunately, it comes down to usually one or two repairs. You're replacing the whole instrument panel with a fairly expensive replacement. But there are shops out there that specialize. We used to remove those and send them off to a guy somewhere out west who knew how to do a soldering repair on it. It wasn't something that we were prepared and able to do in our shop, although I think a couple of my guys did eventually figure it out, but we weren't selling it as a service we did. But we would ship it away, and I think it was like a $40 repair at that time. So, replacing it's expensive. Repairing it is possible. It may be a little tricky to find somewhere that will repair it for you, but it can be removed and sent out. Your car's down for a few days when that happens, but that's
the way it goes.
Yeah,
display screen on mine will turn off or say your car is ready for service or needs to be serviced, and you can defeat that. But I never do because I know I need to get the car in. And that's
sure.
A reminder every time I start it up that I've got to get over to the service department and get it taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Yep, those reminders are good. We all need them, most of us anyway.
Yeah, me in particular. Amy in Milwaukee emailed to say that last year her son ordered new tires online from Tire Rack. He could pick a company of his choice to have them delivered to and then installed for a charge. He chose Discount Tires in Waukesha, Amy also needed new tires this year and got hers from Tire Rack as well. The company website compares prices and sometimes has rebates. And just make that as a, is she making that as a comment? So Tire Rack.
It, you know, again, it, it's a. I have ordered tires from Tire Rack in the past, and you know, they're a good company. Even if you don't get your tires there, I will tell you, it's a great source for information just to do comparisons. Dealers used to be the last place you wanted to go for tires. They didn't used to try to be competitive and try to be in the tire business. They would sell tires and put them on, but price point, they weren't very competitive. A number of years ago at Smart Motors, we decided to go the other way and try to be competitive. And within a couple of years of doing that, we found that we were in a big tire month, October, before winter starts, we sold the most tires of any Toyota dealer. Locally, you know, there's a place called Weber Tire near Sun Prairie, and, you know, it's like that's all they do. They don't even do wheel alignments. They do nothing but tires, and they're very competitive. So if you look around, things like the Tire Rack, Weber Tire, different places, and maybe even your dealer, you know, one of the things I often would, if you've got a really good customer in my shop that's looking at tires that are more competitive somewhere else, I may just give them that discount just so I keep their business. So, you know, you never know. If you have a relationship with a given shop and their tires seem a little more expensive, have a conversation. You might find that you can get a better price.
Hans from Viroqua emailed to say he had a dealer fix $9,000 worth of vehicle damages caused by a collision with a deer. Hans took the truck in with a working speedometer, but got it back with a broken speedometer. Both insurance and the dealer claim it was a coincidence that it broke. Hans was quoted $1,200 to fix it. I asked if we could split the cost, and the dealer said no. So what do I do now?
Wow. Wow. You know, that is quite a coincidence for a speedometer to be working beforehand and not be working after. You know, I it's hard to believe that it wouldn't have been related to the collision, and it's hard to understand how they can say it was just a coincidence. It's the kind of thing where, personally, if it were me, I would be doing a bunch of research to find out how often do speedometers, how often are they known to fail on these vehicles. You know, a dealer can tell you how often they sell a given assembly. They can tell you how often the manufacturer stocks it at a regional hub like in Chicago, where most parts for our area would come from. You know, those would be, I would start being detective and putting some of that together. You know, maybe not something the average person is going to know where to look or how to find it, but boy, that I'm skeptical of it. But unfortunately, sometimes the insurance companies have all the power, and it's very difficult to move their decisions once they're made. But wow, I would be trying to do a little bit of digging to see if I couldn't find some proof that, you know, maybe these speedometers never get replaced in other normal circumstances. And if I found that to be the case, I would present that to the insurance company and say, really, you might want to reconsider this. Take a look at this. You know?
Yeah. And if that doesn't work, you might even call the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. If you have that information, you could share with the consumer protection folks.
Yeah, it's hard to say what evidence you'd really need to prove it, but, it just sounds far-fetched if it was working before that the collision didn't have something to do with it, why they would single that out. But
there you go. Craig in Sauk City, we'll turn to you. Hi, Craig.
Great to hear your show today.
Thank you.
I heard you talking about tires a little earlier, and I had an interesting experience. I had put my car in the garage, and I noticed the rear tire was a little low. So I called my dealer, and the dealer said, well, you know, just leave it in there overnight, bring it in tomorrow, it goes flat, just pump it up. Okay, fine. So in the morning, it was flat, and I went, pumped it up, took it to the dealer, and the only problem was it was flat with the stem right at the bottom. And so you know what happened. Tire went down, the rim came down and crushed the tire pressure sensor in the dryer.
Oh.
And so just a word of the wise, if your tire's low, Joel Parks put the stem down.
Oh.
Right. And that dealer that gave you that advice should be telling people that, you know, if you are going to let that tire go down, whatever you do, don't have the valve stem down, because that damage can occur. Yeah.
Oh. Another thing to think about, but it's something I bet people are going to remember. I'll remember it, that's for sure.
Well, and if you saw the price tag for replacing one of those sensors, it helps you remember too. They're hundreds of dollars again, or probably 150 minimally. So that hurts.
Yeah, that does hurt. Oh, Craig, thanks for calling with that comment. Appreciate it very much. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors. Taking a look at your vehicle today on the program, Larry Mueller here with my guest Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, and was with the company for 36 years, and he is a great guest. He has lots of answers. Kevin in Green Bay has a question, so let's see if we can answer that one. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, like I told the screener, I don't know if this is your expertise, but my son bought a 2022 Kia Stinger, kind of a sports car, and the vehicle has been in the garage 340-some days since he bought it.
Oh.
They replaced the engine. They replaced the subframe twice, and it's had numerous other issues that have gone wrong, and we're trying to figure out if he has any options.
Well, there are. I am not an expert in that area, although I certainly have had plenty of experience having worked at a new car dealership. There are firms out there that absolutely specialize in lemon law and what it takes to get a car classified as lemon law. You know, the number of days that car has been down. Man, they sure suggest that this car is probably going to be eligible for something like that, but it can be a little tricky to navigate. There are actually books that have been written about the subject. So while that is not my area of expertise to be able to tell you just what it would take to have that car bought back or considered a lemon, what you're describing sure sounds like one of the more likely candidates I've ever heard for it. So, you know, but you may have to get some legal advice or maybe just a trip to the library to look at a couple of books, to find out just what the actual number of days during which period of time it has to be for a vehicle to be down to qualify. But that sounds like a terrible ownership. But you know, it's a cool concept of a car, but boy, I wouldn't want that experience. No one would.
No. I was thinking back to when I was about 20 years old. I bought a used Mercury Comet, and I replaced practically everything in that. I my nickname for it was not the Comet, but the Vomit. And back then, and that was obviously a long time ago, I finally sold the car to a friend's son. But I told him, look, I've replaced everything, and here's what I replaced. So it's buyer beware. And he bought it. And actually, I guess after I'd spent all that money, it worked pretty well for him.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I really don't know that I believe there's a thing as a lemon of a car out there, but boy, you have a handful of those kind of experiences in a row on one given vehicle, and you know, I don't care what you want to call it, it's too frustrating, and most of us are going to say, I'm out.
Yeah. Rodney and Merrill, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rodney.
Oh, Larry. Say, I have a 2019 Camry Hybrid with 142,000 miles on it. My extended warranty will be up at 150,000. I'm wondering about the condition of the traction battery. What would be the first symptoms that I would notice for a battery failure?
Sure.
The
first thing you're going to notice is a warning light on your dash, because that hybrid battery is closely monitored by the computer system on the car. And the death knell for those batteries is when it's a bunch of separate cells. It's like a bunch of separate batteries that are connected. And the thing that happens to them when they fail is that one of the batteries will drop voltage a little bit. And if any one battery is too far away from the others, it's going to go into a failure mode. So that's monitored very closely. So that's not the kind of thing. You know, those batteries are not a common failure. They're expensive, so I understand your concern. I'm wondering if there's any way you could determine. But there's no test that can be run on it that's going to do more than the monitoring that the car does with it. And, again, you'd have a warning light on. But what I would encourage you to do is to get that car in and have an overall, you know, have it looked over, have everything checked out good before that warranty expires, just to find out if there are any outlying issues that you do need to get taken care of.
Absolutely. Rodney, good luck. Thank you for calling. Patrick in Madison, your turn. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So about the 90-day warranty cars, I bought one that was experiencing an issue with smoke emissions on startup. Turned out it was the turbo unit that failed. I reported it within 90 days, but the dealership never did check out if the warranty that I had from the, you know, where I purchased it from would cover that. And they also had some trouble diagnosing the issue. So by the time they actually got it figured out, it was after 90 days. So I guess my question is, would there, in your experience, be any recourse there? And I still don't even know if it'd be covered under warranty.
So it was, you reported it 90 days or before the 90-day expiration, but by the time they got it figured out, it was after the 90-day warranty.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah.
And the question really is, who underwrites that 90-day warranty? You know, I mean, and over the years in my career, there are companies out there that are essentially insurance companies that underwrite these things. Some dealers, though, sell enough of them that they start to underwrite them themselves, which gives them more leeway in what they choose to cover or not cover. I'm guessing that this is not one that's underwritten by the dealer, because it doesn't sound like they have that kind of leeway. But if you have your documentation having reported the problem before the 90 days was out, you know, all you can do is keep trying to pick your way up the administrative
chain of command,
rankings of individuals, and see if you can get somebody that will take a look at your documentation and what ultimately was done, and try to make a determination. You know, unfortunately, there's often a lot of small print in those kind of contracts talking about, you know, not just reporting it, but the shop being able to get it to act up. You may report it, but if they look at it and they can't duplicate it, that kind of gives them an out that visit doesn't really count. So it gets a little bit complicated with this kind of thing. But I would, you know, take a look back at the 90-day policy and what the small print in it says, and, you know, take a look at what documentation you have, and see if you don't have a case.
Yeah, there you go, Patrick. I was thinking about that. I bought a stove once from a reputable company, and it went bust about a day after, literally a day after the warranty on it. They weren't going to replace it, so I wrote to the national company. They overrode the local version of it. And, I got it fixed for free, and then it worked fine.
Yeah. Going up the chain of command is sometimes, you know, your last resort, but it can be effective. So yeah, I definitely look at that.
Yeah. Dennis in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. Tires. I have a 2005 Ford Ranger that I got back in probably 06 because of our need for a truck to ship my daughter's possessions down to Houston where she moved. And it was still well under warranty, but now, of course, it's out of warranty, but it works fine. I don't put a lot of mileage on it. In fact, the mileage right now is probably about 38,000. And it's our second vehicle to use for important things like going to the dump, what have you.
Yeah.
But the tires, for a good number of years, and it's only recently that I got new tires, and it wasn't so much with a tread on the tires, but the concern by the Ford dealership that it finally became my service provider for the Ford, mentioned, actually, for a couple of years, that they were a little concerned about the age of the tires, and that right. the issue is the aging of a tire, where the tread might be still looking good, but it can be a factor. And as to the strength of the rubber itself to withhold the air, and of course, the safety fixture issue of blowout. And so, what is the issue of old tires on a vehicle and the rubber itself?
Sure. Tires have been a very popular topic today, and we were discussing earlier that most tire manufacturers have not only a mileage that they say they warranty and they expect their tires to last to, but they also have an age, a number of years. And for most manufacturers, that tends to fall in the range of about 5-6 years. They may do it in months. They may say 48 months, but 5-6 years is not uncommon. And, you know, there are a number of different factors. One of the biggest ones is, besides just tread depth and normal wear, is the effect of the sun on the sidewall breaking down that rubber. And the sidewall of a tire is really what handles a lot of the lateral forces when you're turning and braking and doing a lot of different things. So, you know, it's the kind of thing, when your tires have tread on them, yeah, you look at that and think, boy, there's so many things in life I got to put money into. I really need to replace these. But what you got to think about are the consequences. And a blowout tire can have some very dire consequences, you know, life and limb and property damage and everything else. So, yep, it is important that, you know, it's like with so many things with vehicles, that most of the maintenance that's required on vehicles, whether it's fluids or belts, typically have a time and a mileage. And so many things have happened in our society, so many people work from home, that mileage isn't such a big factor anymore. It's going to be increasingly important that people take seriously these considerations of how much time it's been that these things have been in use. And it's important.
Dennis, thank you for calling. Beth in Fitchburg, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 2021 Honda CR-V, and it's a perpetual problem that when I back typically out of my garage or out of a parking space and with the brake on, it sounds like a foghorn, like literally sounds that way and is very loud. And I've had them look at it. In fact, I just had it in this week for routine. It's always had the routine maintenance that it needed. And they looked at brakes, they've looked at everything, and they can't figure it out. And I just wondered if your guest has any clue or ever heard about that.
Sure. It's in certain models, it becomes a very common problem. It has to do with the makeup of the brake pads. There are different materials that can be used for brake pads. And it also has to do with how the vehicle's used. You know, if you're good to your brakes, that means that you brake early. You don't often brake really hard, you know, and do things like that. But that sometimes can allow some oxidation to build up. You know, manufacturers like Honda or Toyota or any other popular manufacturer will resist coming out with a new part if a part like your brake pad functionally works great. The only thing it does is annoys you and everybody else in the morning, your neighbors and everything, when you're trying to back out. You know, but you know, I've seen the scenario over and over where, you know, the manufacturers would listen to the engineers and say, no, these work fine. That's a normal. It's just an environmental thing. They'll call a lot of different things. But enough people complain, eventually they'll say, oh, okay, we'll come up with some brake pads made out of a different material. You could go into the aftermarket, buy ceramic pads of a different material, or you could try, you know, a simple experiment of, you know, this is not the day to do this, no roads, but if you take the car out on the highway and brake harder a couple of times, you don't want to lock up the brakes and you want to be aware of what traffic's behind you and around you, but that sudden friction a lot of times will grind off the oxidation that contributes to that sound. And if you do that and then you find that it doesn't make that sound again for a couple of weeks or a month, that may be your simplest solution. Or again, you could pursue replacing the brake pads or contact Honda and find out if there is an updated brake pad for that noise concern. But it doesn't mean the brakes aren't going to work right, although those are very similar sounds to what it sounds like when brakes are completely worn out. If someone's looked at them, told you they're not worn out, they're going to work. It's just annoying. But there are things that can be done about it.
There are things indeed. I like the idea of stepping on the brakes and kind of maybe wearing that off a little bit. But you're right, too, Jim. Don't do that if you're in the middle of heavy traffic, for sure. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager, retired as service manager of Smart Motors after, I think it was 36 years, our guest today. And he'll be with us right to the bottom of the hour. And then we'll talk with David Michael Miller about his new book, Breeze, Stevens Field, and Madison. And a big thanks again to those who contributed during our year-end member drive. Thanks to everybody who donated, including folks like Heidi and Jeff from Madison. You've provided an essential service. And if you missed the drive, you can still join in with your gift at WPR.org. We'll be back with Jim Ward right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your vehicle today on the show, Larry Mueller here with my guest Jim Ward, retired service manager for Smart Motors of Madison. It's great to have Jim back with us. And we're going to jump right into the phones because we've got lots of callers online. Brian in Ironwood, Michigan, we'll go to you first. Brian, what's on your mind?
Hi. I picked up a 2020 Toyota RAV4. It had 85,000 miles on it. It now has 95,000 miles on it. Around between like 40 and 60 miles an hour, if you're just cruising on the highway, I get a slight rumble that I can feel through the steering wheel. Sometimes at slow speeds when I'm leaving from a stop sign, after, because I know it's an 8-speed transmission, so I don't know which low gear it is, but I'll get it there too. And the dealer said they couldn't reproduce it, but is this a normal thing with the RAV4s, or is there, you know, it doesn't feel like a torque converter shutter, but kind of like it?
Well, you know, that is exactly what comes to mind when you mention that is torque converter shutter, and it's a torque converter shutter is subtle. I mean, it's something that you feel almost like you're hearing as much as you're feeling, but you know it is the first thing that comes to mind, and it is something that I've seen in RAV4 vehicles. You mentioned that the dealer couldn't duplicate it. What I would encourage you to do is go out for a test drive with the dealer. I'm pretty sure, you know, what you're describing is something you'd probably be able to feel whether you were driving the vehicle in a passenger seat, and if that's true, whether, you know, you take them out and you drive and you know, show them when it's doing it, or you know, and in some cases, if it only does it when the vehicle's cold, you may leave the vehicle there overnight and show up there the next day and take them for a ride. But yeah, I'm never happy when the dealer just says they couldn't duplicate it, because if you were in the car and saying, well, that's it, you see what I'm talking about, then you're on the same page, because people's awareness and, you know, sensory awareness and a description written on a piece of paper sometimes don't make the connection that you could help them make if you were in the vehicle with them. You know, beyond that, I mean, there are other things in a vehicle that could cause some of that type of shuttering, but they wouldn't likely be as intermittently as torque converter shutter is. So, you know, the next thing that I really would encourage you to do is be in the vehicle with the dealer and make sure that they know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Good luck, Brian. Thank you for calling. Chris in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we have a 2008 Honda CRV. This seems to be a Honda CRV day. I've been hearing a lot of calls.
But, yeah.
We have the worst headlights in the world. We had the covers professionally cleaned, and I wanted to put brighter lamps in because it's really hard. We're doing more country road driving than we did in past years, and so it's really noticeable. And they said, well, it might blow out the electrical system. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
Well, there are different bulbs you can get that are still designed to work with that electrical system. There are bulbs out there that that can be problematic. You know, I think a lot of the problem is that so this headlight lens is a material that's not glass, obviously, and it's a composite material that the sun causes to fade, and such that they're pretty soon they're hazed over so badly that you don't get good light through them. You know, the lighting itself might be sufficient if it wasn't for those lenses being hazed up like that. So you may find that if you have replacement lenses that are new, that you don't necessarily have to put in a brighter bulb. And those are something that can be notoriously expensive from the manufacturer. You know, there are a lot of instances when you're going to get a replacement part for a given, you know, make a vehicle like a Honda CR-V, where there's certain parts where, boy, you really better get the Honda part. And there's other parts where it really isn't that critical. We already see what the Honda part did and what the sun did to it. You know, in the aftermarket, I've replaced on a handful of my vehicles. I've replaced the headlights with aftermarket, meaning just an off generic brand that I found on the internet for much, much less. You may find that you can buy both of them for about $140, $150, And they're not necessarily always the easiest thing to do the replacement on. If you're not mechanically handy, you're probably going to have someone else do that. But, you know, I would probably look at, because even if you put a brighter bulb in, within a few months of time, the sunshine's going to cause those to haze up again, and I'm afraid you're fighting a losing battle. I would look at replacing the whole headlight assembly with an aftermarket assembly, have new clear lenses, and I think you're going to be able to see better than ever before.
Yeah. You had another
question. We had them professionally cleaned, the lenses.
Sure.
The lens covers.
That's a buffing that they do, but they're still going to be subject to hazing back up again. They will. It's the same material, and it still has, even though it's clearer now, it is deteriorated, and it is going to haze up that much quicker with more sun exposure, which is not something you're going to be able to avoid. So, you know, I mean, you could look and try a brighter bulb, but I don't think that's going to be a long-term solution. I've seen this scenario many times before.
You had a question about the truck lid, the trunk lid.
Yeah. So whenever it gets roughly below 40 degrees, the hydraulics won't keep the trunk lid up anymore, and we risk getting hit in the head all the time.
Yeah.
And we're wondering, is that something that can be fixed?
Yeah, those struts can be replaced. The struts can be replaced, and newer ones are more likely to. As they get weak, that's the first thing you start to notice, is that colder temperatures, they won't hold up. So new ones are likely to hold it up well in the cold for a few years.
Yeah, there you go, Chris. Thank you for calling. Nina in Menasha, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is just, I would greatly appreciate Jim, correct?
Yeah.
If you could make a statement educating people on PSI of the when filling their tires on their specific vehicle, because I was horrified with my best friend. She was filling up her, I think she has a RAV4, in her tires on her vehicle. She was filling them to 40 PSI of 44. When inside the door, which that's where you get your numbers from of how high to fill your tires, it said 32. So I was worried that we were going to pop a tire in the middle of nowhere. She's like, I've always done this. I've owned it 2 years. So people, she didn't even know that there was that sticker. So if you could explain to people why they have, she says, then why did they put it on my car?
Sure. It's a conversation that we had just a little earlier today, and that is that the tire manufacturer doesn't know what kind of vehicle that tire is going on. The vehicle manufacturer knows the weight and the characteristics of the vehicle, and so that's why the placard on the door is the one you go by. You know, it's running around with tires that are 10 pounds overinflated is a risk of a blowout. Fortunately, it doesn't usually happen. You know, there are a lot of different circumstances, but, you know, it can happen, and you greatly increase the risk of a blowout happening when you do something like that. And, again, it's one of those things where the potential consequences for a tire blowout are life and limb, and, you know, it's just not worth it. So, yeah, tire pressure it's not a complicated thing, but there are different sources of information that can make it confusing. You know, you definitely want to go by the placard that is on the vehicle, not what's stamped on the sidewall of the tire.
Yep. Nina, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Hannah in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Larry and Jim. I have a 2014 Ford Explorer, and I recently splashed a small amount of water on the touchscreen. So now the touchscreen doesn't work. It'll show all the information still. It'll change like it's supposed to, but none of the touch buttons work. You can't control the temperature and things like that. Unfortunately, even though we're very handy, if you want to buy a replacement part, you have to take it somewhere to get it programmed, like an official dealer. So we took ours in, and when they were running the diagnostics on it and resetting it, now it also won't show the visual for my rear view camera, so when I'm backing up. And so I was just wondering, it's so frustrating that so many of the vehicles now having computers and touchscreens, you can't self-repair anymore. But are there any other ways to work around the system or, you know, to get access? I have voice control and I can do a few things, but so much is limited if you don't have that touchscreen.
Yeah, and I, you know, as you said, well, most vehicles have these, and some vehicles have some workarounds with other instrument adjustments and controls on them. You know, I can't tell you on your given Explorer, you know, there are internet groups that are based on what are called hacks and ways of getting around and getting something to work that's been shorted out by water. You know, it sounds like this happened a while ago, and it's been long enough that what's probably happened is electrical short-circuiting. That's probably not, those circuits are probably not coming back. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, this is something that we probably have all thought of this with the cell phone is the bag of rice. You know, if you have something like this happen, and it may be too late for you, Hannah, in this situation, but, you know, disconnecting power from the vehicle, getting that assembly removed and putting it in a big bag of rice and getting that moisture drawn out of it sometimes can prevent the damage process from continuing. And you know, you may regain those functions. But, you know, I think I think what you're dealing with now on your vehicle's display is probably permanent damage from electrical shorting out. But, you know, you might want to get on some Reddit groups or some Google groups and look around and see if people haven't provided some hacks for some of the workarounds for your Explorer. Again, different vehicles, there's not going to be any one set of things that work for every vehicle. But there certainly are hacks out there that people have found to work around some of the things you're talking
about. Okay. Hannah, good luck. Do a little searching around there. Gene in Knapp, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Hi, Jim. The dealership grossly overfilled the oil the last time I got it changed. And it was like, I couldn't, you know, it's like several inches above the highest mark on the dipstick. You know, in fact, I couldn't even see the line in when it was dim light. So what kind of problems might I experience because of that? It's a Prius 2017.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that happened, and you know, it shakes your confidence in a shot, but it's unfortunate it's too easily done. On the extreme end of things that can happen, you're better off to have too much oil than not enough. Not enough obviously doesn't lubricate things that can cause a very high accelerated rate of wear inside the engine. Too much oil, on the other hand, isn't as likely to cause such sudden damage. The big danger of too much oil is if it can get into eventually get forced in the combustion chamber and hydrolock the engine, but that's instantaneous right now damage. And if that occurs, the engine's done, and there's not going to be any question what happened there. But obviously a noise, an engine that's overfilled like yours was, it had to have been very noisy and smoking like crazy, but in all likelihood, it probably didn't damage anything inside the motor. If oil was spraying out somewhere and it got onto, I've seen things like too much oil, an overfilled engine spray oil out and get on the hood seal, and the hood seal then is ruined. Well, that's not as bad as an engine. So I wouldn't say it could never do any damage to anything, but an overfilled engine, usually the remedy is just dropping the level down to the right level, and that's it. And if something like an engine lockout hasn't occurred already, it isn't likely to. You probably don't have any further damage. You know, it's not recommended, but you're way better off to have an overfill and have that resolved than have an underfill and the damage that could occur from that.
Yeah. Gene, good luck. Thank you. Diane in Whitewater, it's your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thank you. I have a two-year-old Chevy Equinox, and the electronics drive me crazy. I will be driving along, and all of a sudden, my screen turns to maps. I will be listening to the WPR, and all of a sudden, it changes to Spotify. And I turn it back, and it changes to Spotify. And I can do that four times in a row. It will reboot my phone, turn my phone off and reboot it. And we bought the warranty for the electronics when we bought the car 2 years ago. But they said that if I take it back to them, they can't do anything about it unless it happens when they are in the car. And because it's so sporadic, there's no way, I mean, I could give them my car for 2 weeks and it would never happen. So I don't know what to do to solve the problem. And a funny thing happened one day. I was so frustrated that out loud I said, "Stupid car." And it answered back to me and said, "I did not understand that."
Oh, perfect. Aye, aye, aye. Well, Dan, one thing, you know, manufacturers do have it out in terms of having the dealer having to duplicate the condition. The dealerships are not allowed to take your word for it that it does something. As frustrating as that is, that's the short end of the stick of consumerism that we have. The thing that I have submitted and successfully made a case for, though, is when a consumer has brought in a video showing the device malfunctioning. So, it's not a good idea while you're driving a car around to be trying to take videos of your display. If you can find a way to safely pull over or have someone else in the car get a video of you doing it, that may be the evidence that you need for this. So certainly there's some kind of a malfunction going on there, it's not likely to be a cheap repair either, but that's what I would encourage you to do. See if you can get it, because you're right. You could, if you have a very intermittent problem, you could leave it with the dealer for days or maybe even a couple of weeks and never have them experience it. So get a recording of it, take it in, see if they'll work with you with that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Diane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jenna in Cable called but couldn't stay with us. Jenna says family members advise her to put heat or STP in her gas tank, but her mechanic says, don't do this. What should she do?
Well, one of the things I wonder about is why people were telling her to use these products. Once upon a time, we had a problem with gas line freeze-up. It used to happen early in my career. Man, I tell you what, I don't remember seeing it in the last decades of my career. Once we started putting ethanol in fuel, that's an alcohol, we didn't have gas line freeze up anymore. And, I wouldn't say that no one sells gas line antifreeze anymore, but you don't need it and you don't really see it out there. But there's a whole generation of people around my age who were brought up using those products in the wintertime at different times of year. So that's one concern, is just is using something that's going to be a gas line antifreeze. The other thing is just something that stabilizes and cleans fuel systems. If you don't use, your car very frequently and gas has to be in it for long periods of time, you do want something in there that stabilizes that gas. That's a different issue than gas line freeze-up. And I do have some products out there. That there's a product called Seafoam, and there's another product called Stable that I think are very good, and they do help clean fuel systems, and they do prevent gasoline from gumming up if it has to be in a vehicle for a long period of time, if you don't drive it much, and that same gas is going to be in there for weeks or a couple months. There are some products are better than others. Heat and STP are some of the lower cost and, lesser quality products of that range, but I do believe in Seafoam. I use it in my vehicles for a multitude of reasons. I think it keeps the fuel system clean, and it keeps the fuel stable and keeps it from breaking down.
Same thing for your gasoline, if you got a gas-powered lawnmower or
right.
One of those things as well, because often that's going to sit for a whole winter.
Yep. And by the time spring comes around, that gas that's left in that little float bowl is more like molasses than gasoline.
James emailed to say he has a 2017 Ford Explorer and got new tires about 2 years ago. Recently, he started to get tire sensor fault messages. His mechanic recommended getting the sensors replaced the next time he gets new tires. This is such a frustrating and expensive problem. Can James disconnect the faulty wirings until he's ready for new tires?
Well, there really is, there is not an easy way to do that because it's looking for a signal. If you disconnect or cut a wire, you're still going to have a light on. You're going to have a flashing light instead of a solid light. Some things to consider. There's always aftermarket and factory parts. So you've got an Explorer. Ford makes a TPMS sensor for it. They're going to be more expensive than a generic aftermarket one. That being said, some vehicle tire pressure computers are more picky than others about working well with and registering and being able to work with those aftermarket sensors. I don't know if Ford being one of those picky companies, Toyota sure was. You know, about 50% of the time, the aftermarket cheaper sensor would be very difficult to get to program with a Toyota vehicle. Whereas something like a Honda, almost self-learn new sensors, whether they're aftermarket or factory. So there may be some cheaper options. Simply cutting a wire, disconnecting it really isn't one of them.
Unfortunately. Well, Jim, you know, winter time, we got emergency kits. What should be in an emergency kit for your vehicle?
Well, I'm partial to chocolate bars, but that's only going to be of limited help for most people. You should have a blanket in there. You want to think about something like heavy-duty garbage bags. You can use that as a rain poncho. You can throw that under the vehicle if you need to, you know, kneel down, change in the tire. If you got a bunch of wet items you got to collect, a shovel is a good idea. Some kitty litter or some kind of traction aid. They make things other than kitty litter. They make bags of sand that have salt in them so it doesn't freeze up and get hard. Jumper cables, or even better than jumper cables, is a battery pack, jump pack that you can keep charging using there. A flashlight is pretty critical. Emergency light, something that you can put on the vehicle or behind the vehicle to make it visible. A first aid kit is a good idea. You want to make sure that you are safe as well. So, you know, it's a good idea to have extra clothes, things, you know, boots. You know, consider that if you're planning to drive your car somewhere in cold weather, if you don't make it, what are you going to have to do to keep you safe and keep you warm? So those are the kind of things that I recommend.
Amy just emailed us from Milwaukee and says, how often should you use a seafoam?
Well, you know, you could. It's something I do not use. Like in my vehicles, in my car and truck, I don't use it like every tank of gas by any means, but I do use it about once a quarter in a tank of gas because I believe it helps clean out the fuel system. In other devices like lawnmowers and snowblowers and things that are seasonal, I am always sure that if I, you know, one of the best bets you could have is to run all the gas out of it. But even if you run all the gas out of your lawnmower in the fall, there's still, you know, a quarter of an ounce, a fraction of an ounce of fuel in that carburetor's flow bowl. So I always try to make sure that the last tank of fuel is run with some of that in it for seasonal equipment so that it stabilizes the fuel over the season that you don't use it. But otherwise, in my cars and trucks, I try to use at least one gas tank quarterly that I use seafoam in.
Well, that makes good sense. Boy, Jim, you've answered a ton of questions today, and as always, you do a wonderful job. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you'll agree to do it again. Thanks, Jim.
I will. It's always a lot of fun. It's always great fun, and I learned quite a bit from your listeners as well.
Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, and he was with the company for 36 years. And he knows a whole lot, doesn't he? Tell you what, we're going to switch gears and talk with you about a new book out. It's titled The Rise of Breeze Stevens Field, Madison's Ballpark and the Team That Made It Home is the subtitle. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. A big thanks to everybody who donated during our year-end member drive. With your help, we received over 2,000 donations. Support from people like Dave and Lois and Madison make WPR's essential service possible. And if you missed the member drive, still time to join in with your gift. You can go to WPR.org. As we turn our attention to a new book, the title of the book is The Rise of Breeze Stevens Field, Madison's Park Ballpark and the Team That Made It Home. And my guest in the studio with me, David Michael Miller, is the person who wrote this book. And it's going to be fun talking with him about Breeze Stevens Field and all of the sporting events and so forth that happened at Breeze Stevens Field. Maybe you have a memory of the stadium from years back. Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. David Miller, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
You know, as I was reading the book, I was thinking about my own participation at Breeze Stevens Field. You know, I've been in Madison a long, long time, and I was starting to count up hours. And I mean, I've spent hundreds and hundreds of hours in Breeze Stevens Field. It's an amazing amount of time over the years. We'll probably get to some of those times involving football and wrestling and everything else. But you're a lifelong resident of Madison, and you've got a family connection with Breeze Stevens Field.
Yeah, yeah. My grandfather, Cliff Adkison, he was the caretaker and groundskeeper of the field from 1938 till when he retired in 1964. And, you know, he was a farm boy from Grant County, and he liked to tinker and stuff, but he seemed like the perfect person to look after the field. He was constantly battling the weather to keep the field in shape, which was ultimately a losing battle. But, yeah, he was there, and everyone knew him. And then in the wintertime, he tended the ice at the Madison Curling Club. So he was an all-season.
All-season guy. So was he part of the inspiration? I guess, why did you write the book?
Well, I was doing genealogy about my mom's side of the family. And when I would do research, I'd found out that he'd been quoted in, like, some of the daily papers by sports writers on field conditions before a big game and so on. And when I was going through, like, the newspaper archives online, that I realized all these things happened at Breeze Stevens Field. I had no idea that the Chicago Cubs played there three different times. The Chicago Bears played there. There were all these Negro team players who had played there, like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson. And it was like one event after the other. And I just thought, wow, this was really a center of the community back then, kind of when Madison was sort of a small town in a way. And it was a story I never heard about and never read about. And I thought, well, I'm going to tell that story.
Well, I'm glad you did. You know, you solved one problem for me right off the bat, because I wondered, I assumed that the field was named for two people, Breeze and Stevens. And then I find out it's one person, Breeze Stevens.
Yeah.
And he was, an attorney? And
well, he was like a corporate attorney that became the mayor of Madison for one term. It wasn't necessarily that successful, but he really made his mark as one of the University of Wisconsin regents. But he really had nothing to do with the field. He's just the one who kind of picked up the parcels and assembled it, but he didn't have any plan or anything. And it was really his widow, Elizabeth Stevens, who worked with people in order to donate the field like 20 years after Breeze Stevens had died.
He bought up lot by lot a whole block, basically, is what he did over time.
Yeah, and a lot of what he was doing was land speculation, and he was related to people like certain senators and leaders of the Democratic Party and the northern part of the Democratic Party. And, yeah, he was out to make money for all sorts of clients out east and big corporations and so on. And
Well, I've as I said in the beginning, I spent a lot of time at Bree Stevens Field. When I was a kid, my friend's grandfather was a big wrestling fan, and he would take the three of us to wrestling meets, professional wrestlers, where we saw the a lot of wrestlers, Jimmy Demetral,
mm-hmm.
and the Sheik of Araby, and
so you said you saw the Sheik of Araby at Bree Stevens Field.
Not only that, but we knew he was always the villain always,
right?
And
yeah.
So this is, I'll give you an idea of my age. We were young kids, and we all had pea shooters. And we took the pea shooters to the wrestling match, and when the Sheik of Araby was up against the ropes, we blasted him with our pea shooters, blowing a little fried peas at him. So I mean, I was a young kid,
right? Well, I mean, it was a blast. I mean, people—that's the stuff that people remember. Now, and also, I mean, was that the match that Joe Louis was in when he was a wrestler? He wrestled there. One time near the end of his career.
I don't think it was. I don't think it was, although we might have been at that one. It's been, you know, that's been a long, long. I was probably, 9, 10 years old at the time, so it was a long time ago.
Yeah, I got to say, part of a job I do is I drive taxi in this town, and what we do is take a lot of seniors to appointments and so on. And you find out they went to high school in Madison, and I go, "Oh, you ever go to Bree Stevens Field?" And they just light up,
oh, yeah.
And they got all sorts of stories. And oh, I was in the band, and yeah. I mean, all these things.
Well, it was, I went to Madison East High School, and we played football there. So I spent a lot of hours at Bree Stevens that way, and it was originally, it wasn't built for. Necessarily for soccer, or it was built for baseball. And she, when Mrs. The widow Stevens sold it to the city of Madison, I'm not mistaken. The deal was, she gave them a deal, but it had to be a sports venue. That's kind of how it got going.
Yeah, that was one of her stipulations. One, that it be named for her husband. And the other was that it be solely an athletic facility. But that was sort of broken in the first year it was open, because they'd hold these neighborhood pageants from all the different city parks, and everybody would turn out, and it was a great community event. And who was going to quibble about something like that? But over time, there were other more non-athletic events. And
But baseball was, the Madison Blues. A guy by the name of Ted Lanahan, I think, kept her going in the baseball part of things.
Yeah, it was built primarily for the schools. And that was the thing that was kind of, Madison was sort of a spot of shame for them, is that all these other cities, Stoughton and Sheboygan and Beloit and Janesville, they had athletic fields, they had their own baseball teams, but Madison didn't have that. Madison, the great capital city, the site of the University of Wisconsin, didn't have an athletic field for its high school. So that's what really lit a fire under people to get things going. And then also, to have the Madison Blues played there. And when they started there, they were arguably the best baseball team in the state. They'd played 3 years before at Kip Field in Madison, right behind Madison Kip Corp.
Yeah.
But they were a huge hit, and they brought in all these other teams from leagues, and also they had a lot of exhibition games against Negro League teams and other international clubs. So there was all sorts of things going on with them.
A local newspaper columnist, who I actually am old enough to have read, was Roundy Coughlin. And he was instrumental, I think, in getting the stadium built, actually, and then in promoting it and keeping it going.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's, if you've been around Madison, you know what a beloved character he was. He was a longtime columnist, sports columnist in the State Journal. He started out in the Capital Times. But yeah, he got the baseball team started. He just decided to throw a fundraiser himself and invite all his buddies. And sure enough, all these businessmen started writing checks, you know, for the new team, for the new field. You know, in a way, I'm not suggesting they change the name of the field because Bree Stevens Field has such a nice ring to it. But it should be Roundy Coughlin Field. I mean, it wouldn't have happened without him.
Yeah. Steven Stoughton has a comment for us, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning. Or is it afternoon? Yeah, it's afternoon. Friday. Oh, so, hey, I've played soccer on Bree Stevens back in the 90s. And it was amazing. The crown on the field is so high that from one side of the pitch to the other, you could hardly see the other player. Like, you might see his head. So given you have a history with a groundskeeper, is there any history on the crown, why it was so high?
Well, I can't speak specifically to that time period. My story kind of winds up sort of in the early 80s. But I think I just assume it was done because of drainage, that they wanted all the water runoff. But as what is written in the book, it was always a struggle to keep the field in shape.
Well, it was built on a marsh. I mean, those.
Yeah. It used to be a swamp, basically. A lot of the east side strip there along East Washington Avenue. I mean, they had a hard time filling that property to make it playable on.
Yeah, and that crown, I don't think that crown, I'm pretty sure. I've watched a lot of matches there in recent years, and you do write about that. Your last chapter or two gets into that.
Yeah. I was going to chop off the story sort of around World War II just to kind of keep the focus on the baseball team, but I kept finding out more and more things, and I just thought, oh, my God, I mean, where do I end this? And I finally stopped at about 1982 when the Madison Muskies made their debut there, and after that, baseball wasn't played there anymore. The soccer, I mean, it's revived the place, and now it's, from what I understand, it's... The field is more popular and profitable than ever, and the general manager was telling me that they average just about one event per day there.
Yeah.
So the facility is
constant use.
Yeah, and it's as popular as ever, and if you've seen, I mean, you can't go around in this town without seeing the pink flamingos on everybody's gear and so on, so for the Madison Forward soccer team. It is more popular ever. And then, of course, it's the concert venue out of nowhere. You know, you have Willie Nelson playing there, Weezer, Robert Plant, just amazing. Steely Dan, I mean.
Keith in Lake Wisconsin will give you a chance. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Larry. I just have to reminisce a little bit. 1968, I was on the Wanakee High School squad, and we played Madison East. And the first thing, we had to get to the park early at Bree Stevens that day to learn how to play the ball off the short right field wall. And that's just a memory that has always stuck with me.
Oh, and that wall, you tell some pretty good stories about guys like Pat Richter or Elroy Hirsch who could whack one over the over that right field wall.
I mean, the thing to say about Bree Stevens, it was really not cut out to be a ballpark, a baseball park.
Yeah.
It's just that it had a short right field, and it just got to be ridiculous. And when the Muskies played there, it was just hilarious. The fans would chant whenever there was a bus coming down East Washington to go bus, 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 to kind of tell the batter, you know, aim for the bus over the field, you know, over the wall.
And they actually built the wall up or something, didn't they?
Well, actually, that happened during the Depression, is that there was just a chain-link fence with canvas thrown over it originally. But during the Depression, all these New Deal dollars were available, and the mayor, Albert Schmiederman and so on, said that we need some public works projects, and putting up a wall around the field was made to order, and they used limestone from Madison Quarry, and it was something it turned out to be just great and took all these people off the relief rolls, and it's just beautiful now. It's just an imperfect step with sort of the prairie school design at the grandstand, and there's no other place like it.
No, there is not indeed. Talking today with David Michael Miller, his book, I had a lot of fun reading through it and reminiscing in my own way about it. The book is titled The Rise of Breeze Stevens Field. Madison's Ballpark is the subtitle, Madison's Ballpark and the Team That Made It Home. Maybe you've got one to share. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Miller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Miller here. Just a note on Garden Talk tomorrow, Woody Kerwin, we'll talk about landscape lighting, and then we'll talk with Jacob Grace about the Savannah Institute. It's a nonprofit promoting agroforestry. Right now, we're looking at the book, The Rise of Breeze Stevens Field, with its author, David Michael Miller. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about some of the folks that you wrote about and some of the things that happened. One of the things that interested me, and I'd kind of forgotten about, was the UW played games oftentimes at Breeze Stevens Field. Diney Mansfield was the coach.
A few games of the baseball team played there, and they also played the Madison Blues quite regularly. UW football team, the varsity team, never played there, but they did have some other games going on there, and they also did play other Big Ten teams, like you say, Diney Mansfield and so on. We play Northwestern or Purdue or so on. And you
talk a bit about Elroy Hirsch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He broke through in 1942 on the UW football team when, you know, everyone knew him as Crazy Legs, and they almost won the Big Ten title. Mm-hmm. But it's during the war. Mm-hmm. He signed up to be a Marine, mm-hmm. and before he was kind of sent to boot camp, someone suggested, we should play a baseball game in Madison. And he was on, when he was in Madison, not only was he on the university team, but he was also on various city league teams and like Badger Sporting Goods and so on. He just wanted to play. And he also would play basketball and do other things. But there was a big, someone suggested a big game that would be a war bond rally. He was on the Badger Sporting Goods team, and it was the full stadium and so on. And sure enough, the bases got loaded, and then Elroy came to the bat and just slapped one, a grand slam, and then the crowd went nuts. And it just so happened that it had been planned that there'd be an auction of some of Elroy's trophies, like his track shoes and the football from a 1942 game, and the bids on them were just astronomical, and it just raised so much money, and it was just such a great community event that everyone could share in. It was a real wonderful moment.
And Pat Richter may have played one sport or another more than almost anyone else. Pat's a great guy, by the way. I served on the athletic board when he was director of athletics here at UW.
Yeah, I think he really basically grew up at Breeze. I mean, he was a bat boy for one of the city teams, and then he was a manager for one of the little league teams, and then soon enough he was on the East High football team. His father, I guess, was a big football captain in his day. And, Pat Richter was an all-rounder. He was a great basketball player, baseball player, all of these things. It's just wonderful. And then, he went on to, become the athletic director of the University of Wisconsin. I'd like to think all that experience sprung right out of Bree Stevens Field on East Washington.
And we can go back to wrestling for a minute, too, because I think that was kind of an important time. At least there was an important individual, Jimmy Demetral.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Talk about him, because, you know, we have Demetral Field, for example. It was an honor given to him. But what was Jimmy Demetral like?
Well, he was a Greek immigrant. He came to America in 1912 and got a job, you know, working factory and so on. And his original name was Nicholas Zarakos, but he began sort of wrestling around the Chicago area, and he had a mentor, this other wrestler named William Demetral, who was also from Greece. And he convinced Jimmy to, you know, pose as his brother like he'd done with other things and, you know, have him on wrestling cards and so on. And that's what he did. And Jimmy had his first match here in Madison at a pavilion that used to be at Olin Park. And after he won his match, he announced to the crowd that he was going to move here. He loved it here. He trained with the UW wrestling team, and he worked out at the Y and everything. And he lived here for, you know, the next 60 years.
And he promoted a lot of things here in Madison, including Bree Stevens Field, and was really honored for his work.
Right, and he held annual wrestling cards, benefit cards, to benefit to disabled children and to, like, let them go to kiddie camp and, you know, enjoy a camp out. And he was just such a colorful character. Everyone knew him, and he was a bona fide quality wrestler. He won a world champion middleweight title in 1928, and then a few years later he won the light heavyweight title there. So,
yeah.
then he also did things like he wrestled bears.
We make a buck one way or another.
Well, and he promoted in it. This was, you know, the kayfabe and everybody and all the, you know, having these heels come in and costume and be acting like these villainous foreigners and all these things, all the wrestling stuff you see today.
The Bree Stevens Field itself had gotten into a lot of disrepair in our last couple of minutes. Talk about that and the rejuvenation to what it is today, but it was in pretty bad shape.
Well, right, and the thing was, it was just from overuse. It was the only lit stadium for a while, and all the area high schools played there, and including places like Edgewood High, you know, mm-hmm. that weren't necessarily part of the city school district. And just from overuse, it just got torn up all the time, and it just it was nothing that my grandfather could have done. You know, it just meant constant resodding and throwing sand on everything. And it just got to ridiculous, and I guess some kids got hurt playing football there. And so finally the city decided we need an alternative field. So they started building something at Warner, but it was really Mansfield Stadium when it was built behind today's Memorial High School in the late 60s. That's what really took over, with a decent field with a track. And then the prep school games kind of moved away from Breeze, and it just wasn't the place that it used to be.
And there wasn't money, or at least there wasn't a willingness to spend a lot of money on it.
No, there wasn't. But, I mean, it did, you know, they did after in the 80s decided it was going to be a dedicated soccer facility, and through time it got to be more and more popular. And then flash forward to the year 2014 is when they decided to put artificial turf in. And that just changed everything, because now they weren't spending all this money and working on the field all the time. And now they just had a field that was ready to go anytime. And it really turned things around. It's kind of an irony, my grandfather being the groundskeeper there. But the thing that really revived the field was putting in artificial turf.
Isn't that amazing? And now we've got a venue. We've got the very popular U.S. Soccer League Madison Forward Soccer Club and Ultimate Frisbee Association, Madison Radicals.
Yeah. People and these teams, from what I understand, they love playing there. They love playing this in this old facility. It's a real matter of pride for them.
Yeah, a lot of work had to be done to fix the place back up again and actually make it safe.
Yeah.
For people, but in the end, we wound up with a facility, as you said in the beginning, that gets used almost every day of the year.
Yeah, yeah. It's
an amazing story, and we haven't begun to touch on all that you've got in
well, I guess
the
you'll
show.
Have to have me back sometime, huh, Larry?
I guess I will, David. Thank you so much for being with us. David Michael Miller is the author of The Rise of Breeze Stevens Field, subtitled Madison's Ballpark and the Team That Made It Home. A really fun talking with him. Take a look at the book. You'll probably be like me if you're of my age and think back to all of the times you spent at Breeze Stevens. And you'll hear about some famous people as well. Great to have you with us today. Always great to have our team, Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins. Big thanks. And executive producer Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mealer.